You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
That catchy little lick is from Wishbone Ash and their newest single called We Stand As One off their latest release, Coat of Arms, Steamhammer SPV release. Hello, podcast listeners. This is Pat Prince, editor of Goldmine Magazine, and welcome to the Goldmine Podcast. We'll be talking to Andy Powell, guitarist vocalist for Wishbone Ash. And Wishbone Ash has been an influence for many rock and rollers over the years. And their live recordings are just as good. They've put out plenty of studio albums. And their latest studio album, which includes the song you heard, We Stand As One, is called Coat of Arms. It comes out as a 2-LP set with 140-gram black vinyl and a gatefold. And Andy will tell us all about the success of Wishbone Ash, if he believes that Wishbone Ash should have been more popular in America. They certainly were very popular in England. And what he thinks of this latest release, Coat of Arms, compared to all the other studio albums that Wishbone Ash has put out in the past. Okay, we'll be right back with Andy after this message.
Hey, I'm Ronald Webb, and this is Patrick Prince.
And together we host the Goldmine Radio Hour, the show that features the latest issue of Goldmine,
the music collector's magazine. Tune in Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on CygnusRadio.com.
Hello, Pat. How are you?
Andy Powell, how are you?
I'm good, man.
So are you calling from the road with Uriah Heep and Nazareth? Are you in Europe?
Yeah, we are actually on a tour. Yeah, we're on a tour in Germany, and the three acts are playing shows every night, and then we go off and we do a slew of dates by ourselves, and then after that we go and tour the States through the South and the West Coast and stuff. Yeah, so it was about 2 months of touring, yeah.
Yeah. You're going to be busy all year, from what I see.
Well, we're always busy, but yes. Yeah, this is a busy year because we have a new album.
Exactly. And isn't it true that it's been 50 years ago this month that your debut album was released? Is that correct?
Yeah, it's. I don't know if it's this month. I think it could be. Yeah, I think it is. We're certainly celebrating the 50th year. I mean, the band was formed in... in 69, October of 69. So the whole year we're kind of using that kind of banner, you know, that's what we're touring under. But we also happen coincidentally to have a new album, so it's perfect synergy, really.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that it was a debuted album 50 years ago, and now you have this new album, Coat of Arms, and I got to tell you, leading off the album The Right Way with We Stand As One, it's a great, has a great repetitive guitar lick throughout. It's really catchy.
Thank you.
And you even said yourself it's a great anthem song.
Yeah, well, you know, none of this stuff was contrived. I mean, the song was inspired, obviously, a little bit earlier in the year, last year, by the fact that, you know, Amazonia was on fire. Yeah. And everyone was going, oh, my God, not the Amazon, you know. And we knew, obviously, that, you know, logging was going on there, clear cutting, and they're trying to introduce counterfire. And, I mean, you know, I'm somewhat political, but it was just shocking to me, you know, because, like, getting back to the trees in Connecticut, you know, I love trees, I love forests, I understand what they bring to us, you know, and so that was shocking. So that inspired the song, and then, of course, subsequent to that, everywhere else started burning, Indonesia, California, and now look at Australia. It's an absolute tragedy, you know. Yep. And, so I'm like, you know, I put this song together, and it's just, it seems to be very current. And I feel, you know, we go on stage and we play it, actually, and I feel very impassioned about it, you know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a piece of music. It hits you right between the eyes, I think.
Yeah, with a song like that, with such a message, it's good to have it as an anthem type song, I think.
I mean, we didn't set out to do this, but it just seems to have worked. And I'm really encouraged by the response that we're getting from people, you know, as they hear it for the first time. And that's very, you know, it's rewarding, you know.
Well, you have, it's a double whammy, so to speak. You have that great, like I said, guitar lick, melodic. It sticks in your head. And then you have the message of the song as well. And
yeah,
you said yourself, it's... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, carry on. Go on.
You know, you could say it's a little political, but something like this shouldn't be political. I think that's the message in the song. It's almost like, let's stop being tribal and let's stand as one to protect this shared planet. I mean...
Yeah, well, exactly. And, you know, the initial, what I was observing was the indigenous people in Brazil were coalescing and forming themselves into, you know, a group to stand as one against the Bolsonaro government. Mm-hmm. And that was where that phrase came from. But I think that it goes beyond political. It's just like, oh my God, what is going on out there? You know, mm-hmm. We better really be paying attention. So, get back to the music. I mean, it's got some strong earworm characteristics to it. Yeah, the big riff. And what was really nice about putting it together was it was just a wonderful thing to be working finally in the studio with my new guitar partner. He's been in the band for 3 years now, which is Mark Abraham. So, you know, that little earworm riff was something he came up with.
Really?
And I said, you know what? Yeah, I said, you know. So, yeah, and I mean, so I said, this is a great way to debut yourself on the album, you know. And that inspired the song. So, you know, he played it to me, and I went, that's killer, you know. So, you know, like when musicians are getting together, you kind of like produce one another. And you go, nah, that idea sucks. Or, no, that's got something. And then, you know, I pulled that out of him, and he was delivering, you know, that and then the heavy riff behind it. And then we put it into a song. We worked on that together. And then my son actually came into the picture. He's a drummer, and he kind of came up with the opening lines on the lyric, and then we completed it.
Yeah.
So it was a nice communal effort, you know, all round, and using these younger guys to kick me up the ass with a great idea, so to speak.
Well, you even compared it to the classic The Warrior, which is a heavy rock anthem.
Well, it struck me that way. You see, the thing about Mark Abrahams, he's now been on the road with me for 3 years, and he started out playing guitar, being influenced by Wishbone Ash.
Yes.
So, at the age of 9.
Wow.
So he's got this kind of DNA in his system, in his guitar style. And you know, I mean, it's just been so rewarding to actually get in the studio with him, because he kind of like reminds me of these directions that we went down, these avenues. And you mentioned the song "The Warrior" from the Argus album, which, you know, is it's a strident, anthemic song, and I think that, you know, there's some songs on the album which definitely harken back. You know, we're not trying to ape the past, we're not trying to mimic the past, but these songs harken back and they pull out strands, you know, streams of consciousness that were there on earlier songs, on earlier albums, without being, you know, kind of like a tribute to that. You know, it's just, I mean, we're at that point in our career, really, 50 years, if you think about it, we've created such a definitive style that we're even influenced by our own style. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, I don't have to dig around, listen to other bands and go, oh, you know what, I think we should try and sound like ZZ Top on this track. I don't need to do that, because I've got like 24 or 5 albums of music. And it's like, hey, do you remember when we did that cool, they went down that cool direction with such and such a song? Let's try and develop that strand a little bit again now. And we could do that when we're in a rehearsal room and we're trying to come up with new songs.
Well, it makes it even better that someone like Mark, who was influenced by you guys while learning guitar, and I'm wondering if Argus was one of those albums that he picked up and was turned on to, which would have been pretty cool.
Well, he was. No, he totally was, because you know, his father was a fan. Ah. So he was sitting as a little boy in a car driving back and forth to school or wherever they were going, and he would be bombarded with his music. And yeah. I mean, it's a funny thing, you know, like, I mean, this is, we have a generation now of people who are younger, but they hear this music and they're like, you know, where did that come from? So yeah, I mean, he's just a part of the whole picture. That's all I can tell you. And when I play with him, you know, it's like age doesn't have anything to do with it. You know, you just kind of like got the same influences, and he's tapped into my sound. He'll remind me of the band's direction as it used to be. You know, and he knows it almost more intimately than I do. Sometimes I'm a bit oblivious to my past. You know.
Well, it's cool. That's a good point. He points you out to things that you might have.
He does, yeah. Yeah, he keeps me focused. Yeah, it's good.
Well, I saw the video, and, well, first of all, it's cool that he's finally playing on a studio album with you guys.
Instead Very of just cool. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Now, the secondly is, I saw the video for We Stand As One. It's a damn good video, and it's live, it's mixed in, and you're playing your Flying V, which is very cool.
Oh, yeah, I always do, man, yeah.
Yeah, that's like a
that's me.
That's signature. And what is it about the Flying V that you have loved over all these years as a guitar?
Well, you know, I bonded with it when I first. I mean, the Flying V was a bit of a dog. It wasn't a guitar that was used in rock. It was the Fender Strat or the Les Paul. That was it. And Gibson came out with that guitar, you know, and no one really wanted it. Everything didn't. Because you kind of you have balls to pick up a ridiculous looking thing like that, and you can only do one thing with it, which is perform, right? Yeah. So I was in a store buying some equipment, Orange Gear in London, and this guitar was hanging on the wall. I picked it up, and I immediately realized this thing sounded really good, you know, even before I plugged it in, and I knew about the guitars, you know, but I was like, could I play one of these things? I plugged it into this equipment, and I thought, this sounds really good, you know, it's got the tremolo unit on it, the vibrola, and I was like, yeah, you know, and I on a whim, I just bought it right there, £300, that's about, I don't know, what would that be, about $370, brand new, it'd been in a packing case since 1967, we're talking 1971 when I bought it, 72. And I just immediately bonded with the thing. I was a skinny 120-pound kid, and this big guitar, Flying V, a lot of wood in that thing, you know, with fins sticking out the back, and I just wrapped myself around it, and it became my thing. And people immediately kind of latched onto it.
Yes.
And before I knew it, you know, all the people in the press, photographers and stuff in the British magazines who would come out, the weekly press, started putting pictures of me in the papers because they thought it was eye candy.
Yes.
You know, and so before I knew it, other bands started using it. I mean, Mark Boland picked a Flying V up And then the next thing we see, you know,
Michael Schenker
a little bit later. Yeah, Michael Schenker. Well, yeah, definitely. He used to come and see our shows. Rudolf Schenker.
Yep.
In fact, Rudolf ended up buying some of my guitar, my Flying V collection from the 70s.
Wow.
He's got a ton of my guitars right now, actually. But, yeah, so it became, it suddenly started to become the guitar being associated with rock and more specifically metal.
Yes.
But, you know, Wishbone Ash is not a metal band, as you know. But,
right.
You can see how it all developed.
But I remember as a kid seeing you on the cover of Kerrang with that Flying V. And it was kind of, for a kid, it was eye candy because it was like, wow, that's
a cool
thing.
Yeah, well, you know, you got, what is that? I want one of those.
Yes.
I get it. Yeah, I mean, you know, we all fantasize over guitars. I mean, for me, the first guitar I loved was the Fender Stratocaster, but then it just became the Flying V, and I just thought, it's such a cool, and it sounded great, and I made it mine. And I bonded with that instrument, and I still bond with it. I still love the sound of Flying V's. I've got many of them, and I these days I have them, you know, I have they're kind of customized for me and so on and so forth. But the old, the original thing still works, tried and tested, you know.
So you still have the original one you bought for £300?
I do. I had that 67. I mean, I later acquired a 58 and a 59. I mean, those things are about the price of a house now, you know.
Yeah.
But those went to other people. They're such fantastic mid-century artifacts. I mean, I have some replicas of those guitars, but you can't take those things out on the road.
Yeah.
You can't take a 1959 Les Paul. You just can't take them out on the road.
Right.
Worth too much money, you know.
So we can't expect to see you with that original Flying V.
Actually, well, tell a lie, I have played it in and around Connecticut on live shows. So I do pull it out from time to time, and I'm not afraid to use it. But if it's a long tour and it gets thrown in the back of a truck, I'm a bit worried about it, you know.
Yes.
It's got a lot of mojo, that guitar.
Oh, yeah. If you go on stage without any Flying V, people will be disappointed. You're kind of...
Back in the 70s, I tried to switch over to Gibson Firebirds.
Yeah.
My manager at the time, Miles Coburn, he came out and goes, Andy, you can't do that. I went, what do you mean I can't do that? He says, you're the V man. You got to stick with the V. I went, well, you probably got a point, you know. So I ended up selling the white Firebirds to Stephen Stills. He bought it. So, yeah. And I went back to the V.
Well, let's talk about some of the title other songs. The title track, Coat of Arms. It has a sort of Steely Dan boogie to it. I like that. Do you agree with that?
I do, actually, in a strange way. You know, maybe that's us playing Steely Dan back because, you know, I don't know if you know this, but the song Reeling in the Years.
Yeah.
Right? If you listen to the outro riff on that song, they copped to Wishbone Ash twin lead guitar part from the song of ours, Blowing Free. So maybe we're paying them back. I don't know. But no, there was no intent. There was no intent to be that. But I think that's a strong observation in a way. It's a nearly 8-minute track.
Yeah.
Goes through a lot of movements. And it's a pretty sophisticated little bit of rock.
Yeah. You know, I hear that a lot from your fans that they think that other bands were so influenced by your melodic guitars. Like, for instance, Lynyrd Skynyrd and Freebird. Halfway through that, people thought it was like Argus, the instrumental bits.
Well, I think the irony there is that we, way before they had Freebird, and I'm not going to take anything away from the success of Freebird, it's been a phenomenal song, but we had a song about a bird, and, you know, they would have seen us play that, and that song was called Phoenix, and we still play that song on stage. I mean, Phoenix is our anthem, and it starts out ponderously and slow, and themic, and then it goes into this kind of rocking guitar workout. So, you know, there's lots of songs like that. I mean, you listen to the band Thin Lizzy, you can hear parts of our riffs.
Absolutely.
Even bands like Metallica, you know, you can hear. And that, to me, that's a great honor to have your peers, you know, kind of reference a band mm-hmm. like Wishbone Ash and to be influenced by the guitar things that we did. I mean, to me, it's only good, you know?
Yeah, I agree with you. Instead of feeling like they pinched it, it's more like it's a, you know, they're sort of tipping their hat to you, like you guys.
Tipping their hat, yeah. And that's a good thing. I mean, everyone's influenced by something.
Yes.
You know, and there's a way to pay tribute, you know. If you plagiarize, that's
one thing. Yeah.
But if you pay tribute and tip your hat, that's another thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, they say every poet is a thief, so.
Yeah, it's true, you know. I'm a fan of music. I'm listening all the time, and I'm producing stuff, and I'm sure the stuff that I listen to somehow worms its way into some of the inspiration for songs here and there, you know.
I mean, they say you guys were always influenced by the Yardbirds, the dual guitar playing, but the twin lead guitar kind of came.
That's true.
Came by accident, right?
Yeah, well, no, I think with Wishbone, if there's any band that you were influenced back in the day, it would have been Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac.
Okay, probably, that makes sense.
Because they were dabbling. They did more with twin leads, I think. But then, of course, we took it so much further. I think the Yardbirds thing was just an accident. I think they dabbled with very, very briefly. But I think Fleetwood Mac did some cool stuff with twin leads. And then, of course, when we came to America, they paired us on bills with the Allman Brothers, who I wasn't really aware of. But that was a different type of thing. Our influences were a bit more English and church bass and folk bass, and theirs obviously was country and blues. And but it was great, you know. I love playing with the Allman Brothers. But I think that by now we've probably taken it further than pretty much any other band, I would think.
Do you think that Wishbone Ash got too much of the British rock tag instead of maybe that could have done better in America? Or how do you feel about all that?
Well, you know, we've always been a band that's been somewhat under the radar.
Yep.
We were never sort of tied in with hit singles from one decade or another.
Yes.
And there's a double-edged sword to that. The one good thing about it is it's produced this band with incredible longevity. You know, because we're always like, you know, we're known as a players band, we're known as a touring band, and we're not limited, you know, by that. But the other side, as you say, I mean, we got to quite a good level in America. We were touring and playing municipal auditoriums. We're doing 10,000-seaters and so on. And we had a brief run there where we had bands like Aerosmith opening for us, we had ZZ Top opening for us, we even had Bruce Springsteen open for us.
Yeah.
But, you know, eventually then the tide turned and we would end up opening for them. And so we never became that band, like, say, something like a Genesis. And then the British thing, yeah. You know, I mean, you know, there was a very brief period there where Britain ruled the waves as far as, you know, rock bands, touring bands, prog bands, progressive rock bands. But we fed off all of that.
Yeah.
And I don't think it really impacted us. I think one of the cool things was the fact that we signed with MCA, Decca MCA, in Los Angeles. And back in the day, the key thing about that was the distribution. They were able to push our product, as they call it, all around the world. And so, you know, that was another thing that really tied into the longevity of the band. So, you know, you could go to any country. You could go to the Soviet Union, you could go to Japan, you could go to Finland, you could go, and people would come to the shows with our albums. Well, that wasn't always the case with other bands. So that kind of like locked us into a touring thing, and we just ended up being this band that toured forever.
Yes. Well, I almost felt like in the beginning of the 70s, being a British band helped because of the 60s. And then sort of like in the mid-70s, people were looking for more American bands here, at least.
That's true, yeah.
And,
well, you know, you had the rise of bands. You know, by that time, the Americans had learned their lessons a lot.
Yeah.
You got to imagine, like, the first bands that really kind of got stadium rock going were bands like The Who from Britain.
Yes.
I mean, they really got stadium rock across to Americans. And then, given a couple of years later, the Yanks learned their lessons well. And then you had bands like Boston and Journey.
Yeah.
And
Aerosmith.
They just took those... They took those lessons, and then they just took it even further. And then they, you know, with the fantastic ability of the American way to sell this stuff, you know, sell themselves and to market it.
Yes, that's huge.
It became all highly organized, you know. And then, of course, we had a band open for us at Long Beach Arena. It was a band called Kiss. And we were big. We were headlining.
Yeah.
And they opened up and they did their show and they came on in their ridiculous outfits. And we're like, that's just so cheesy, man. That's never going to work. You know, that's got no cred to it whatsoever. And how wrong could we be? They took that, they realized the circus aspect of rock.
Marketing.
They realized the visual. Marketing and visual. And they realized how to do it. And they turned that brand into something incredible. Yeah, we were too busy being musicians, I think.
Yes. And I think, you know, as a fan, I just felt like... I wish that Americans would have listened to Wishbone Ash more. And I felt like Argus was such a good representative of, you know, classic rock. It had a little bit of everything in it. Prog, classic rock, all the good stuff that came from the 60s, really, and going into the
70s. I think you're right. And in a way, it was really an honest representation of where we were at the time. One side of it was very English, you know, songs like Come Down the Sword and Warrior. And then the other side was reflecting our new experiences of being touring in America. You know, I think songs like Blowing Free and Time Wars were more American in their style. And I think that, it's just young guys being honest and just shooting from the hip, really.
Yeah.
Before there was any kind of marketing. Of course, the closest we came to the marketing aspect of that album was really the artwork for it, which was the Argus. Yeah, I mean, you know, we had this incredible team, Hypnosis, designing these album covers.
Yes.
So, this art rock style about the band that people loved, you know. We're talking, you know, opening up those big LP covers and this was real art. I mean, album art was at the peak at that point.
Oh,
so we tapped into that.
Yeah. I have all my original Wishbone Ash on vinyl. No CDs. It's all. It's got to
awesome,
be vinyl.
Man.
It's got to be vinyl, because that's how it came out. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Now I got it all too.
Now you feel comfortable with the new lineup. You're touring and you're going to be touring all. I guess I could see you on the East Coast in the fall. I guess you'll be touring.
Yeah, in the fall we'll be coming around. Yeah, for sure.
And. Because you'll be touring, I think you have a break during the summer. I'm looking at it now, but basically you'll be busy all year touring. And as a veteran rock musician, does touring doesn't get tired for you? I mean, how do you look at it now compared to?
No. I tune right into it, man. I mean, it's normal life that gets tiring.
When I
come out on the road, I'm in my zone. You know, I mean,
good point.
I'm energized. I mean, right now talking to you, you know, I'm energized. You know, you're reminding me of my history, and I'm playing on the road. Yeah, it's physically very tiring. But it's very, you feel alive playing, and I'm a big travel freak, so I do, I love, practicing my, schoolboy German on tour in Germany, and, I'm a big, you know, I'll try foods from anywhere, you know, I'm not one of these guys that go, oh, I can't eat Japanese food, or, oh boy, I can't do that. I'm like, bring it on, I like to try it all, you know.
So you don't stick in the hotel, you adventure out.
I do, yeah. I mean, I'm open to new experiences, and it's just stuff coming at you every day. I'm a proactive, positive sort of person, so I love travel. That's a big part of being in a band. So I buy into all of that. And physically, it's tiring. Yeah, I will agree. There are aspects of it.
Well, physically, you look great. You look great. You're gonna be 70. I mean, you look fantastic.
That's crazy, isn't it? Yeah.
You have probably more energy than I do, and I'm in my early 50s. So, I think it's great.
Oh well, you know. I mean, music's great. It keeps you young. You know, we can tell you.
Well, keep on touring. Hey, is there still bad blood with you and Turner, Martin Turner? Is that still going on? Is there ever going to be?
I think it's calmed down somewhat. I mean, we had the court case. We had to battle over the name. You know, I'd never stopped doing it. I never quit. I'd never left any of the companies and the partnership. And And so it was really that scenario with the court case was people around me, the people that depend on a livelihood, you know, that were saying,
I hear you.
You know, agents, record labels, you know, you got to go to court. I wouldn't say, I mean, we don't hang out together, we don't talk, we never really, but I mean, you know, we both share this history, you know, I mean.
You do, and that's what fans care about. Fans,
of course, and I get that. Yeah. I totally get that. You know, I can't. I don't have any. I'm just like, it's just a fact of life, man. You just have to deal with it. He had to deal with it. Now he's, and I'm glad. I'm happy for him. He's out on the road and he's playing our music in a different format, in a different way.
Well, I hope one day before you guys turn 80 to see you guys jam on stage again.
I never say never, man. I never say never about anything. I'm open. I'm a completely open book.
Well, peace, and I hope to see you on the road, okay?
Well, thanks so much, Pat. Nice talking to you. Yeah, keep in touch.
Thanks, Andy.
Cheers, man. Bye.
So, listeners, pick up Coat of Arms by Wishbone Ash. They are on tour starting this month, and they will continue on tour through March in the U.S., okay, this is Pat Prince, editor of Goldmine Magazine, signing off. Don't forget to check out Goldmine Print Magazine in Books A Million and Barnes & Noble select stores out there. Also, select record stores. You can find out what those stores are and latest issue in the record store directory, or go online and find out at goldminemag.com. You could also get exclusive content and also a percentage off the subscription price. Okay, see you next time. Bye now.
Hey, this is Brad Page from the I'm in Love with That Song podcast, inviting you to join me as we explore a different song each episode, discovering what makes these songs great. The performances, arrangements, and the production tricks and techniques are all part of creating those magic moments that turn a good song into a great one. On this podcast, we take a deep dive into each song, listening to all those nuances that came together to make it a great song. Our journey takes us across the musical map, from the Beatles and the Stones to Aretha Franklin and Tom Petty, Kiss, The Cars, Todd Rundgren and Roxy Music, from Badfinger to Al Green, Stevie Wonder to David Bowie, from Aerosmith to The Zombies. We listen to it all on the I'm in Love with That Song podcast. You may be unfamiliar with some of these songs, and some of them you've probably heard 100 times, but I bet if we listen closely, we can discover something new. So, join me on the I'm in Love with That Song podcast, and let's listen together, because I think you're going to love these songs too.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.